the Skyline Studios, high above Columbus and Wacker Drive. This is Anna DeVlantis. Good to be with you. My first day back after the holidays.
Yeah, welcome back.
Thank you. Missed you guys.
You had a nice long break.
I really did, and I've got to tell you something, guys. It's great to be back. It's great to have my house back, because I don't know if you heard me talk about the big, fat Greek and Italian family. I love my family. I love cooking for them. I love hosting them. I love having them come and go and all the kids and the engaging and catching up. And then I need my space back.
So for this entire time, back. You've been hosting different
constantly.
People.
Constantly. Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's a lot of sheet washing.
I love it. It's sheet washing. It's cooking, which I love. Towels. It's picking up after kids, which I don't love. And then there's, you know, just a lot of kind of like fun family stuff, organizing, like charades. I just love doing all that stuff. And yet at the end, it's sort of like, okay, you know, there's an
it's exhausting,
overwhelming
though.
Part of the holidays. And I just hope that you all had at least a moment or two to catch some breaks and take a breather. I know, Jisook Yi, you were working quite a bit, so you didn't really get that break.
I didn't, but it was nice. It was really nice to, you know, fill in. I know your listeners are happy to have you back. I did the best I could
to
honor your time slot.
You did
Thank
a great
you.
Job.
Yeah. Thank you. You did a great job. I just want to ask you guys, anybody make a New Year's resolution? We were talking earlier. I did not make one, but did you sometimes? It's 30% they say.
I did.
You did?
Yes.
You want to share it or you don't want to share it?
I will totally share it. It's a little bit different this year. Usually I say I want to lose weight. I want to eat better. All that stuff. And then I end up breaking my resolution on day three.
30% of people also break them by the end of January.
So this year, I said that I want to be a little more forgiving to myself.
Oh, that's a really good one.
So I think in particular, women are very hard on themselves. And I think when you're trying to do everything and be everything for everyone in your life, especially if you're a working mom, Anna, which you are, it's very difficult.
You're stretched
to,
in a lot of different ways.
Yes.
Or if you're caring for an older family member or so many other things that pull us in different ways, a health problem in the family, things like that.
And I'm a perfectionist. So for me, that adds on more pressure. So I'm always really hard on myself.
Lauren, did you make one?
I didn't because I, for that reason, am hard on myself when I don't accomplish them. So
I feel like there's so much pressure when the champagne glasses are out or when people go around the room like I'm doing right now. I'm sorry about that. And you say, what's your resolution? To make it a big one, like a life-changing one, rather than my goal this year is to lose 2 pounds. You know, it's like, that's not enough. That's not big enough. You got to come up with something bigger.
Well, New Year's Eve is so anticlimactic. I hate the holiday because you feel as though you're going to wake up and everything is going to be different. It's so funny. While you were gone, John Hansen and I were filling in, and Steve Bertrand was also talking about how he doesn't stay up. He doesn't stay up to see it.
It's going to happen anyway.
Right. Yeah.
I didn't stay up this year either for the very first time. I made it to like 11:20, 11 almost, like a little later. Steve, you made it about there too?
Yeah, about there, 11:15. By the way, my resolution is to be harder on Lauren and G since they're going to be easier on themselves.
Somebody's got to.
Right.
Oh, somebody's got to get them going. But I think like it's easier sometimes when you do little goals to kind of keep, that's for me at least, to propel you through the year, that I think it's easier for me.
But see, you're already feeling the pressure because you felt as though you needed to have a resolution and you felt bad that you didn't have one.
That's true.
I think overall, just live a better life for yourself and others. Make it very broad. That way it sounds like a great big goal, but how you're going to do that is up to you.
Right. The desire to lose weight topped the list yet again this year, 35% of people. Eating healthier, again, 31%. And you know what's interesting is those are higher, much higher than resolutions like seeing friends and family more, 15%. Or getting a better work-life balance, kind of sort of what you were saying, G, 12%. Finding more time for myself also,
12%. What if you want to see your family less?
Yes, that's exactly why I think after the holidays, that's sort of a
just
mixed
kidding.
Thing.
I love my family.
No, I love them too. And I don't want them to think any differently from what I just said. But that's interesting that people set more like personal weight goals, more so than lifestyle goals. But in the interest of all this, I think this is, we have a great guest today. It's Dan Buettner. He is a National Geographic explorer, and he's written these Blue Zone books. So he's studied, he's gone all around the world for years and years, and he studied these zones where people live the longest, the highest concentrations of centenarians, people who live to 100 or above. And he studied not only what they eat, because there's a lot of detail on that, and there's even diet books that have come off of the Blue Zone original books. But there's also a lot to be said about lifestyle and how these people live. And you would think that there might be sort of a health wealth equivalent, but most of these places are not wealthy areas. They're very simple lives. And it's sort of a message, I think, to simplify your life in ways that you can. Now, there's some things you just can't do. A lot of these people in these zones, and we're going to talk to him about it in more detail, but a lot of people in these zones tend to grow a lot of their own food, which in Chicago is pretty difficult to do unless you have a greenhouse or a big backyard and you're very talented and you can eat squash in the winter and pumpkins, I guess. I don't know what grows here. But then other than that, there are some zones where time is not really an issue. You can kind of show up whenever you want. There's no pressure to constantly be on these deadlines of making this meeting at this time, answering this email within a certain amount of time. So those are things that are hard to replicate, but there are other things that totally you can bring into your life.
Well, you do hear about these studies that say that Americans work more than other wealthy countries
way
in the
more.
World. We're less efficient and we're less happy.
Take less vacation and feel the pressures of the job even when you are on vacation. I think that's the other piece
always
of
connected.
It.
Absolutely.
Always.
We don't even take sick days. Mm-hmm. We come to work sick.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to talk to Dan Buettner. I read one of his books over the holiday, and it inspired me in a lot of ways just to kind of learn about these lifestyles and take away the things that you really can apply
this
to your life.
This is your resolution. You will now live as though you live in a blue zone for 2020.
It's so hard to do. There's a moment when you're romanticizing and thinking, gosh, could I grow my own food? No, I can't. But there are lots, like I said, lots of things to take away from his message. So I'm excited to talk to him. And I was so excited when he said yes. Right after I read the book, I reached out to him and I said, hey, would you come on WGN? And he said, absolutely. And share his ideas.
Nice.
So pretty cool. Coming up also, Jason Erkes is here. He's going to talk about marijuana. How's it going in Illinois? A couple of the dispensaries have little notices on them today that say, sorry, out of supply. The demand is there, that's for sure, but the supply maybe not, especially for recreational. It's they're kind of limiting themselves to medical only. But he's going to talk about kind of how things are going at this point. Not even a weekend, we've got the recreational marijuana thing going, and he's great. Go ahead, Steve.
And it's not going well. I mean, it's going well. It's going gangbusters. But, you know, today, Block Club is reporting there's only one recreational store open in the city of Chicago. Because, well, for a variety of reasons, some are out. They don't have product. Cresco said that they have product, but that they don't have enough workers, that the state has been too slow in approving workers for these dispensaries, so they had to give them a break today. I don't know if that's just a positive spin on things, but, you know, they're kind of, everyone's trying to take a breather today. Some stores, according to the Tribune, might be closed all week.
And didn't we see this coming? Wasn't this a worry?
Right. They've got grow lights, right?
Oh, goodness.
It's amazing to see what those lines, right? I think Jason Erkes, our next guest, actually equated it to what you saw outside Apple stores when they release a new product. And it's fascinating to see that. Maybe you could have foreseen that, but it just was amazing to see that constant flow. And I'm wondering who the people are. So I'm going to ask Jason about that. Are these people who were getting it already?
Kind stocking of up?
On the black market?
Oh, yeah.
Or were
I'm
they
sure.
new to marijuana? Or were they people who smoked it in college and said, I want to revisit it? Or I don't know. I want to understand that a little
bit. It would be interesting to know what the percentage of that is, but I imagine there are a lot of people that were already smoking it.
Oh, yeah.
Or eating it or whatever.
And then taking it across state lines is an issue, too, because some of those dispensaries are set up right along state lines, and you saw the people come over from Wisconsin and Indiana.
It's like fireworks.
It's like, here we go. We've got something here in Illinois that's worth coming for. We're going to talk to Jason coming up here on WGN Radio. Stay with us. Back here live in the Skyline Studios, this is Anna DeVlantis, along with Jason Erkes. He is the Chief Communication Officer for Cresco Labs, which it owns Sunnyside Dispensaries, and he's here to talk about how recreational marijuana is going. And we were talking about the problems earlier. We're like, well, we knew these problems are going to happen. These were anticipated.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, everyone knew all along this was kind of a soft launch of the program. All the dispensaries aren't open in the state, and all the cultivators and growers have really been ramping up to be able to produce more supply since the governor signed the legislation. So this is no surprise to anyone. And, you know, the good thing is there's constantly new product coming to market. None of these shortages are going to last for a very long time. And but the overwhelming amount of people that lined up in these stores across the state was really a shock to everybody.
Was that a shock even to you? Because I saw those lines, and I know you equated it to the Apple store lines that we see when there's a new product, people camping out, people coming from far and away to line up and try to get the maximum amount they're allowed by law, and waited a very long time to do so.
Yeah, I think this outweighs a new iPhone coming out. It outweighs a new pair of Jordans, a new Popeye's chicken sandwich. Add them all together, and these crowds were certainly certainly longer than that. When we you guys were talking about being asleep by midnight on New Year's Eve, 11:30 right here in bed, 11:30.
Well, you've been busy. You've got
but
a different
we started
for
the day at 3:30 on New Year's Day, and as I was walking up to the dispensary, there were just hundreds of people out there waiting in line. All the media was out there, and it never slowed down. It still hasn't slowed down until last night at 10 o'clock when we closed.
Your company, you put out a statement yesterday saying that you'd be closed today because of worker availability, not shortages of product, right? Or both of those true?
Yeah, no, we're doing okay on supply right now. I mean, everyone's running a little low, and we are as well. There's certainly products and strains and things like that that we're out of, but we still do have product available. But we had to give our staff a break. I mean, they've been working since 6 a.m. on New Year's Day, pretty much 15-hour days for 5 days, and we just wanted to shut down today, give our staff a break, reset, take inventory, and get ready for what's to come.
So Monday seemed like a good day to do that after a busy weekend.
Yeah, we figured also people would be going back to work today after the holidays, so it was a good day to take a rest.
Just one more thing. The statement implied that the state has been slow in approving employees for you, and I didn't know that the state had to approve it, but is that the case? Should the state be moving more quickly?
Well, I mean, I can't say that. I can say that, you know, this whole program has ramped up very quickly, and there have been a lot of things that both the growers and the dispensaries in the state has had to get done. But, you know, we certainly need to build our staff and be able to accommodate crowds like this a little more efficiently.
What's the popular product at the dispensaries? What are you running out of the most?
You know, the flower product is really the most traditional form of cannabis that people know. So people have been buying a lot of flower. But, you know, in the wake of the vape crisis that's been happening around the country, I think a lot of vapes have been selling really well because people know that they can buy it from a trusted and regulated source now. It doesn't have any of those additives that the CDC was reporting as a health issue. So and edibles probably third. So flower, vapes, and edibles have been very, very popular.
Have you had a good amount of people that have never use the product before kind of asking questions about what's best for first timers?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of new consumers. I mean, everyone is now a new legal consumer, right? So we had people working the line kind of explaining the different types of consumption, dosage, and what kinds of products were available. A lot of questions were asked, and it was really great. People were waiting 5 or 6 hours on average in line, and nobody was complaining. You know, we were passing out food, passing out drinks. We had a magician and a comedian come by to kind of entertain people in line, keep them occupied. But, you know, there was no outrage from people that were waiting. They stood by, they waited, and they walked out smiling with their Sunnyside bag in their hand and their legal cannabis products.
So have you kind of had some polls or some sort of data that has been produced about who shown up so far? To Lauren's point, are they people who were already doing it but now are going to a dispensary rather than wherever they were getting it before? Is there a number of people who maybe did it in college and said, I'll give it a try? Maybe people who are just holiday users? Or do you have people who are other types of users who have come to the dispensaries? Do you know any of that?
I'd say D, all the above. It's really an equal mix. I mean, you have people that have been buying product in other markets, whether California, Colorado, when they travel and illegally bringing it back. You have people that have been buying product in the illicit market here. And then you have a lot of new consumers that either tried it 20 years ago or haven't ever tried it and have heard, you know, hey, this might help me sleep. This might help me relax. I hear this can be uplifting, and we're getting a lot of questions, a lot of people that are very curious and now want to try the difference between legal regulated cannabis that's tested and child safety sealed versus the things they might be buying on the street.
So what are the biggest questions? And once they get in there, what are they asking about?
A lot of questions about edibles, actually. You know, safe to say that everyone has had a bad edible experience in their life. Anyone that's tried cannabis has probably ended up on a couch thinking, I might have had too much.
Or accidentally had an edible.
Or accidentally, right? So, you know, today's products are very different. They're lab tested, they're dose regulated. So when you take something that says 2.5 milligrams or 5 milligrams on it, you know exactly what you're getting, and you can you can use it, add to it in the future if it wasn't enough, take some away if it was too much. So I think the edibles are something that people are asking a lot of questions about because they want to understand the microdosing and the appropriate place to start. But a regulated dose edible is something that didn't exist before.
All right, we have a caller, Madeline, on the line. She wants to talk about, I think, her experience. Madeline, you're on WGN Radio.
Yes, hi, good hi. Morning, and Happy New Year. No, I was just listening before the commercial break, and they were saying, like, what kind of person, and the gentleman said it's all over the place. I'm a 69-year-old teacher that lives in the northwest suburbs, and I have been smoking ever since the late 60s, early 70s, almost on a regular basis. I can't stand alcohol, and of course have always thought that you know, marijuana is should be in the same category as alcohol. I'm a one-hit wonder. That's all I need in the evening.
Very good. I love that, Madeline.
And just, yes, and I was already starting to admit that I smoked pot when I knew it was going to be legal to some of my teacher friends, because I'm really tired of hiding it, you know, because I go to, I went to all kinds of parties, and they go, oh, you don't drink? And, you know, then I'm like, no, I smoke pot.
Let me ask you, Madeline, are you smoking for any, is there any chronic pain issue? Is it to relax? What would you say is the number one driver?
No, just for entertainment, really. It just sort of, I personally, everybody's chemistry is different, but personally for me, it's just kind of an enhancer. The body feels better. The movies are, you know, I get more detail. You know, I laugh easily. I love to laugh. Love to be happy. It just puts me in a very nice state of mind and body.
That is such a cool story to share. Did you feel the pressure before to do it alone, or did you have some secret friends you'd go smoke with?
Well, no, I have friends. I mean, and I've bought my stuff, of course. I've got some stuff from Colorado, but since I've been smoking since the late 60s, I couldn't always get it legally. You'd be amazed at the amount of white suburban mothers that really love pot. So,
I probably wouldn't be, actually, because I probably would not be. But that's a great story, Madeline. Thank you so much for sharing it. So
I just thought I'd come out of the closet and let people know, you know, because people, when they look at me, they, you know, they don't even think I own a pair of blue jeans. I turn out fairly well. I present fairly well. I love kids. I'm a teacher. So I'd probably be one of the last people you'd think. But I've been in the closet for a long time and happy to be out.
And now you're out. That's awesome, Madeline. Thank you for sharing that. That is so cool.
Well, you're so sweet. Thank you for the program. I appreciate your time. And once again, Happy New Year.
You too. Happy New Year. That is interesting, Jason, Madeline's story, because that may be more of the consumer than we would have thought.
Absolutely. When you look at the lines that were forming outside our dispensaries, and I'm sure others around the state, you know, there was no stereotype, there was no stigma associated with it. You had grandparents, you had baby boomers, you had people that were teachers, people that were construction workers,
athletes, high performing people.
Yeah,
some of the high performing people I know are always doing marijuana. They did edibles and they would never talk about it, much like Madeline.
Right. I mean, you could look at the line, and it could have been a line to go into any business on Michigan Avenue or anywhere in the city. It didn't represent a cannabis line.
Which is funny, because also to the other side, so many people think of people that smoke pot as the tie-dye wearing, long hair, very chill, maybe not bright. It is so far from the truth.
So
we had a couple of those in line. I mean, I'm not going to deny that. And there's a guy out there with a flag and like fully head to toe. He had a cannabis suit on, you know. But yeah.
I heard one guy interviewed. It sounded like he had already smoked quite a bit. And it was like, wait a minute, you're in line still. How do you sound like that?
Exactly.
What's going on there? A lot of questions, though. And I know Illinois is now, it's legal, recreational marijuana as of January 1st. But some cities and towns have rejected it. So there are places where you can't buy it, but you can still smoke it
exactly.
And use it.
Yeah, the consumption laws are statewide, but certain municipalities around the state have said, we don't want a dispensary in our neighborhood. But the truth of the matter is, for every municipality that said, we don't want a store here, the one next door raised their hand and said, well, we'd like it here. We'd like the tax money. We want to buy a new fire truck or buy new schools for the new books for the school, you know, or something like that. So there's plenty of dispensaries that'll be going in across the state.
And we've been pointing out as well, I saw the interviews with the people who have the dispensaries, and I think your company is at least one of them who right along the state lines. And you saw a number of people come over from Indiana and wait in line. You can't take it back across. That's up to you how you're going to, you know, deal with that. But if you do come, it's a way of bringing some of that money and the taxes into the state of Illinois, I suppose.
Yeah, we have two locations, one in South Beloit, which is near the Wisconsin border, that we'll be opening, and one in Danville, which is near the Indiana border. And as G said earlier, it's very much like fireworks, right? You can go across the state line and buy them, and then where you go with them is kind of up to you.
We were so used to in Illinois of going across state lines for other things that it's a strange thing, I think, to see people coming here for a product. A lot of people asking about, the biggest question I often hear is, how is it tested when a police officer knows if you're under the influence? I think that's still sort of a gray area that needs to be sorted out.
Yeah.
Alcohol tests, they have those tests. Marijuana tests, are they really there yet?
you know, there's a lot of technology being worked on for that, and I don't think that they're there. But I think, you know, they do the same roadside test for impairment, you know, that you'd see with alcohol, where they're getting out, asking you to walk a straight line, touch your finger to your nose, recite the alphabet backwards, which none of us could do sober anyway. But, you know, things like that. I think officers have training to be able to tell when someone is impaired, and that's really what they're trying to look for.
What are you going to be looking for now, the next steps in marijuana, recreational and medicinal, in the state of Illinois?
Well, for us, you know, we're opening an additional 5 dispensaries, so we're going through the zoning and regulatory process to get those open. So we're opening up some stores, you know, downtown in the River North area and Gold Coast area to make it a little more accessible. And then, you know, there were tens of thousands of people that lined up in the first week. And I think as it becomes more accessible, those crowds are going to grow, and it'll be something that'll be a little more socially acceptable here in Illinois.
People like Madeline coming out of the shadows.
Madeline's not alone.
She is not. I believe that entirely. Jason,
I want to shop. I want to do the shopping, but I don't want to wait in the line. So when do you think is my window there?
Good question.
You know, that's a great question. I don't think we could have anticipated the lines that we saw this week. So hopefully they'll start to regulate a little bit, and things will level off both from a supply standpoint and from a weight standpoint.
And hopefully the concerns about it, too, I think will sort of, as we mentioned, the police officer enforcement part of it gets figured out as well. Jason Erkes, good to see you. Cresco Labs is the company. You're the chief communications officer, and come back and update us sometime.
Thanks.
Soon.
Thanks for having me.
Back here live in the Skyline Studios, Anna DeVlantis along with Lauren Lapka. I'm really excited about our next guest. It's Dan Buettner. He is an author. He travels the world. He's a National Geographic Fellow, New York Times best-selling author, I should say, a number of books, and a lot of these books have the words blue zones in them. And the blue zones are these areas around the globe that he's traveled to over a number of years now with a team of scientists, a team of experts to study the people who live the longest on Earth. And these people don't just live long, they live, for the most part, disease-free for many, many years until much later in life than we see here in the United States. And they tend to live happier lives, I think. Dan, would you agree with that? That there's also sort of a happiness component to the whole thing? Welcome to the show, by the way. Thanks for being on WGN.
Hi, Anna.
Hi, Dan. So I was wondering if, you know, there's a lifestyle component to this. There's a diet component to it. But I think from reading one of your books, and I sat down and read over one of them over the holidays, The Blue Zones, 7 Secrets of the Longest Living People on Earth. And it was interesting to hear about how it seemed like they, and for the most part, lived very simple lives, but they also seemed quite happy.
Well, the keen insight here is that they don't try to live a long time. In other words, they live in environments where the healthy choice is the easy choice, which is a big shift from the way we think about health. We think about health as something that we, you know, find the right diet, find the right exercise, and then find the discipline and then stick on a program. But the reality, what really seems to work is shaping your surroundings like people in blue zones does. So it's easier to get movement every 20 minutes or so. Vegetables like and beans and whole grains are the cheapest and most accessible foods. And it's impossible to just implode into your handheld device. You have to socialize, which we know leads to a happier, healthier life.
We should define the blue zone. Sardinia, Italy, Okinawa, Japan, Nicoya, Costa Rica. It's a peninsula along Costa Rica. Ikaria, Greece, and Loma Linda, California. That particular community, the only one in the U.S. so far. I mean, I know there's a potential you could discover more of these.
Well, part of my work is we're taking these concepts, Blue Zones concepts, and putting them to work in cities. And actually, insurance companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield are actually paying for us to create cities like Orlando, Florida, and Fort Worth, Texas, and the whole islands in Hawaii to shape their policy and their environment to make it easier for Americans to make the right choice when it comes to their health.
Well, that's the interesting part about it, because reading through it and just naming those particular places all around the globe, you could think, well, what could possibly be the common values of all those places? I mean, they can't possibly be eating or living the same way in Okinawa, Japan, as they do in Sardinia, Italy, or this place in Greece, an island off the coast, way off the coast of Athens, or Loma Linda, California. The diet can't possibly be the same, but in many ways they were eating beans, and there were some commonalities in their diet.
Well, as you probably know, I have a number one best-selling book right now called The Blue Zones Kitchen, where I spent 10 years to do a meta-analysis of what people were eating in these blue zones. And no matter where you go and you see long-lived people, they're eating mostly whole grains, greens, nuts, tubers like sweet potatoes, and then the longevity all-star. If you're eating about a cup of beans a day, it's probably adding 4 years to your life. Because maybe it's the fiber, maybe it's the protein, or maybe it's because it's replacing things like fatty, disease-ridden pork, and that's what's helping them live longer.
Yeah, I mean, all of them didn't seem like they were vegetarians, though, except for in one community. They all were meat-eaters. They just didn't have a lot of it. And the other thing I was...
Five times per month.
The other thing that strikes me is in America, I think we often think of health in some ways is equated to wealth. If you can afford to eat fresh fruits and vegetables every day and you don't have to go to the fast food restaurants, that's much healthier, and it's much more expensive to go to the grocery store constantly. In a lot of these cases, they were growing a lot of their own food, which isn't necessarily something achievable to a lot of us who live in places like Chicago.
Yeah, but that's where we get it all wrong. We think we have to buy, you know, organic fresh fruits and vegetables to be healthy. In the Nicoya Peninsula of Costa Rica, they spend 1/15 the amount we do on health care. They're well below the U.S. poverty line, but yet they're about half as likely to die in any given years. And once again, their secret is they know how to take simple peasant food like corn tortillas, beans, squash, rice, and cook it and make it taste good. And they get some tropical fruits, but no, you could eat a Blue Zones diet for under $1 a day and stack the deck in favor of living an extra 10 years more than the average person in Chicago will live.
And it's putting off disease, too, which is the other component to this. It's that they eventually do get the same diseases we get in America, but they're not fighting them for years and years and years. They're getting them much closer to that 90-year mark or beyond than we tend to get them here. Isn't that right, Dan?
That's right. The value proposition is they avoid heart disease. They get about one-eighth the rate of heart disease, one-fifth the rate of breast and GI, or gastrointestinal tract cancers. They get about a fifth the rate of dementia. And virtually no type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is almost completely avoidable with a Blue Zone diet and lifestyle. We see that in looking at these populations of long-lived people everywhere.
So do you think that could also be with the lack of sugar and unprocessed or lack of processed foods?
Yes. So the average American consumes, without really knowing it, 22 added teaspoons of sugar every day. And in Blue Zones, it's about 8. And when they're putting sugar or honey in their food, they know it. Yogurt, we all think yogurt's really healthy. Well, yogurt has more sugar ounce for ounce than a Coke does. And there's just so many insidious sources of sugar in our diet. And yes, that is shaving years off their lives.
And I should mention, when you go into these zones, you do bring a team of experts, and you've been doing this for many years now. You have the National Geographic folks, but you have scientists, data people, you have medical people, and you really take a scientific approach to bringing in this data that you then compile in your books. It's an important thing to do than just go and show up and start interviewing someone.
I'm a National Geographic fellow, and we take evidence very seriously. It took us 2.5 years before we were actually able to confirm that these Blue Zones were long-lived. And then I follow up with a team of about 12 people who go into these places and really try to find the common denominator and find out what's correlating. We can't determine causality, but we can tell you what the common denominators are in the longest-lived people in the world. And, my books, I think, do a really good job of making them easy to translate.
They totally do. I would definitely say that. A lot of the people who you studied as well, as we all go to the gym and talk about New Year's resolutions, they are walking a lot. They walk to the store. They walk down the road to see their friends. They're not getting in their cars nearly as much as us. I don't know if that's totally transferable, but certainly walking is a pretty cheap thing to do. It's free.
You can raise the physical activity level of an entire city by about 20%. This comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, by optimizing how your city planners design streets and sidewalks and bike lanes. So, yes, it is possible. What's not going to happen is if we currently let the automobile completely, quote-unquote, drive our transportation decisions. When when you cities can decide to build streets not only for cars but for human beings. And when you look at places like Boulder, Colorado, or Fort Worth, Texas, even, or San Luis Obispo, you have the lowest rates of obesity in America, largely because city planners have decided to favor quality of life over making it easy to drive from point A to point B.
Let's talk about some of the other lifestyle issues that you talk about, that you have in the book, other than far apart from diet. It's about how people have some sort of engagement in their community, and a lot of it, lifestyle things like having friends and family members close to you, having a group of friends who support you. There were a lot of their sense of purpose. There were a number of things that also seemed to be there, be present in the lives of the people, no matter where they lived around the globe in these blue zones.
I would say the number one modifiable health intervention that everybody listening could do right now is pay careful attention to who they're spending their time with. I mean, face-to-face time. We know if your three best friends are unhealthy and obese, your chance of being overweight go up by about 150%. And what we see in blue zones, places like Okinawa, people create what they call a MOAI, M-O-A-I, which is an intentional social circle of 3 to 5 friends that they invest in each other. And they tend to be friends whose idea of recreation is playing tennis or walking or gardening, friends who they can count on a bad day, and friends that also eat a healthy diet. Because we know that health behaviors are measurably contagious. So by just shaping your social network, you're creating a long-term strategy that's going to make the healthy choice the easy choice for you.
Yeah, it's just fascinating the things that you've learned over the years. And I know you're taking those principles, as you referenced earlier, and bringing them to cities. There are a few cities here in America you've tried them out in. How did that go, Dan? Give us an update on those.
Well, Fort Worth, Texas is the biggest one. We've been working with Texas Health Resources and the mayor there, Betsy Price, for the last 5 years, while obesity has gone up almost everywhere else in Texas, we saw a 6% drop in obesity in Fort Worth, and we saw about a 2.5% drop in smoking, which doesn't sound like much, perhaps, but in a population of almost 1 million people, that translates to about $250 million a year in healthcare cost savings over time. So it really does work, but it requires a comprehensive policies, restaurants, grocery stores, workplaces, schools, and a critical mass of individual willing to shape their surroundings to make the healthy choice the easy choice.
Dan, a question from a listener, 773. How helpful is this starting at the age of 40 or 40 plus, I suppose, would be the other part of that question.
Oh, my God. Whoever that is, she's a youngster. You can start at any. You could be 99 and make a few changes and add to your life expectancy. But more importantly, it's how you feel. People who are eating a plant-based diet and moving every 20 minutes and have a good social network, they're going to feel better tomorrow. Not only add extra years to their life. I mean, we talk about longevity, but what I'm really talking about is increasing your vitality and your quality of life every decade between now and the time that you go up to heaven.
There was a wonderful story, too, that if people buy your book, Blue Zones, 9 Lessons for Living Longer, there are so many other Blue Zone books about happiness and the kitchen and diet. But in that one that I just read, there's a great example of a man, 55, who started living this way. And it was a remarkable transformation in his life. So I appreciate you checking in with us, Dan. I was so excited when I read your book and said, I wonder if he'll come on the show. And you said yes, and emphatically so. And I thought, gosh, this guy, you know, really just cares about spreading this message. Of course you're selling books, but you've been on this for a long time and transforming people's lives. So thank you for
joining us. Plus, I love Chicago. I go there every Christmas. So it's good. It's near and dear to my Midwestern heart.
Good. Good to hear, Dan. Dan Buechner, National Geographic Fellow, New York Times bestselling author. Find his books, Amazon and all, where all books are sold. You just type in, you Google it with the Blue Zones, and all your books pop up. Isn't that right, Dan?
That's right. And Blue Zone Kitchen is the one that just came out.
Just came out this year, yeah. Thank you, Dan.
Sweet.
Appreciate talking to you. We appreciate your time. Much more to come here on WGN Radio, including we're going to talk to Jim DeRogatis. He's the person who many credit as breaking the R. Kelly situation and exposing that for the first time. He just appeared in the new Lifetime documentary, and he's a former Sun Times music critic. He's been syndicated, and he's been covering music for a very long time, but he happened upon that story years ago in Chicago, and he's going to bring us up to speed of where we are now.
The last 2 years where I felt like I didn't want to live anymore. You know, it was just dark.
That's a little piece, or a little clip, I should say, from Surviving R. Kelly Part 2 on Lifetime Television. The first one that aired months ago was one of the most viewed programs ever on Lifetime and widely credited with being the show that revealed so many women with so many of the same concerns about R. Kelly that we soon after saw criminal charges brought against him, which he's currently facing right now. Jim DeRogatis is our guest. He's a longtime journalist covering the music industry, including for the Chicago Sun-Times. And Jim, you're the one most people credit with saying you first exposed this when you, what, received a fax years and years ago?
Yeah, I mean, the story started for me, Anna, in November 2000. Our first piece in the Sun-Times ran December 21, 2000. And it's never stopped. I mean, why it's taken 19 years for this man who sold 100 million records, the most popular artist Chicago ever produced, the biggest R&B fan of the star of the last two generations, why it took him 30 years to face justice, it's just unconscionable. You know, there are 48 women whose lives he's ruined, whose names I know, and I believe there are many more.
You find yourself, you're a music critic. You're probably covering him for the same reason, because he's this rising star from Chicago. He's extremely talented. He's got so many loyal followers. And then you find yourself in the middle of what appeared to be a videotape of him with an underage girl that somehow.
Well, the videotape came to us in February, the first Friday in February 2002. The first story had been December 21, 2000. You know, I was a journalist who was out there listening to women. You know, I'm white. My partner at the Sun-Times, Abdon Palish, was the court reporter. He's white. We were ringing doorbells on the South and West Side. And, you know, the thing that was curious is no one ever said, "I hate that monster." Mm-hmm. They said, "Brother has a problem. Brother needs to stop." And then they invited us into their homes and began telling us these stories of how their daughters, their sisters, their aunties had often underage sexual contact with Kelly. In other cases, like Lenita Carter, who just told her story in Surviving R. Kelly Part 2, she was of age, but it was unwelcome sexual. It was rape. It was rape. Mm-hmm. You know, the charges now that he faces, to put it in perspective, as a student of popular music, as a critic my entire career, no one in the history of popular music, which has a very long, sordid past of treating women badly, from well before Frank Sinatra through Led Zeppelin to Ryan Adams, nobody has ever faced 42 felony indictments in two federal and two state cases. It's unprecedented. By my count, if convicted of all of those 42 charges, he could spend two centuries in jail. There's never been a monster like this, and he operated preying on young black girls in Chicago for 30 years. Victim number one, who told her story first in my book, Soulless, and then last weekend in the Lifetime series, Tiffany Hawkins. That was 1991. He preyed on her and five of her fellow 15-year-old sophomores, many of them students at Kenwood Academy in Hyde Park, and then Aaliyah, you know, who has been added belatedly 30 years late, you know, to the federal charges out of New York. It's mind-boggling, really. Everybody in Chicago, churches, schools, the court system, civil attorneys, the rest of the media, everybody failed these young black girls. And the thing that I have been amplifying, that dozens of black women have told me, is this: nobody matters less in our society than young black girls.
Well, I remember after you first exposed this possibility that was going on, I was a young reporter at NBC5 at the time, and I was sent out to the neighborhood several times and knocked on doors, much like you and Abdon Palish did, and heard similar stories and had people who this videotape was widely circulated. People would show you it in their house and they'd tell you who the girl was. And they'd say they'd claim allegedly that there were people who were paid off and that people suddenly had money they didn't have before and that things like this happened. And then I remember covering the first trial several years later, and a lot of it fell apart based on people who wouldn't testify and the
Now we know why. I mean, the federal indictment out of Brooklyn makes clear that the girl on the videotape and her mother and father, who never testified, all were bribed by Kelly not to tell the truth in that trial, and that other witnesses that they couldn't buy were intimidated. You know, he's hit with, among all of the other charges, sex trafficking, sex with minors, making child pornography, he's hit with a RICO case. Which to me is fascinating because, you know, in my early days as a beat reporter in New Jersey, I covered innumerable stories about the Genovese and Gambino crime families, you know, and the way that feds go after the mob or a drug cartel like El Chapo's is with RICO, you know, racketeering. And they're saying that Kelly ran a criminal enterprise. Two of his associates are indicted along with him, that was designed to fulfill his sexual desires, often for underage girls.
Now you are, go ahead.
You know, it's mind-boggling.
Jim, you're part of this series, and what would you say came out of? I did not have a chance to watch this part two. What would you say were the new things that came out of this next the Lifetime episode two?
Well, you know, it is hard to watch. You know, the pain of Lanita Carter, who was a hair braider assaulted by Kelly, the pain of Tiffany Hawkins, victim number one, has never spoken to anybody but me, and now she told her story on camera. Dominique Gardner, who spent 9 years of her life, a girl from Rogers Park, was underage or just barely of age when it started, is now about to be a mom, approaching age 30. You know, stayed with him for 9 years. Despite he would beat her with an extension cord, he choked her, he starved her, he locked her up. You know, I think that the power, you know, without the journalism that me and Abdon Palish and Mary Mitchell did, the series would not have been possible. But the emotional impact of seeing these women on your TV screen in your living room telling their stories, one after another after another. I mean, you think about it. The first was 6 episodes, 6 hours. The second is five more hours, 11 hours of women telling their truths. You know, it's just undeniably, it's a bucket of ice water in the face to anyone who would still defend him. And the heartbreaking thing is many of them in the new episodes say they have faced nothing but vilification, threats, and violence and insults on social media and in person, at the shopping mall, at the Jewels, at their church, at their backyard barbecues. People so love this man who rose from busking on the L platforms in the Loop to become the dominant voice of R&B for, as I said, 30 years. You know, people love him, and they do not want to believe this, even though these women are their sisters, their aunts, their daughters. It's really a heartbreaking story that gets at so many aspects of Chicago black life.
Mm-hmm. You know, and we're running out of time here. We should mention, speaking of defending him, his attorney, Steve Greenberg, has said on a number of occasions that the women are not telling the truth and that he will have his day in court. It looks like several days in court, as you pointed out, because a number of charges now facing R. Kelly in the coming months, right? Jim, we're going to start seeing these trials?
You know, there's a tentative date for the start of Cook County's case by Kim Fox against him in April. But the two federal cases in New York and in Chicago and the case in Minnesota, and there's other cases that are still in the works, charges pending, civil lawsuits. Anna, this is going to run on for years and years and years. But Kelly has been denied bail by the federal government. He's never going to breathe fresh air again. There's no way that 48 women are all lying. Mr. Greenberg can blame the victims. That is just insulting, absurd. I don't think it's very good legal practice. Right. You know, the courts have failed this man, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about tomorrow night at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Is that open to the public?
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to be sitting on a panel with the great Mary Mitchell and Mortalyn Ijikahira of the Chicago Sun-Times, two black women whose voices need to be heard, because it's really time for me as a journalist to shut up and for people to listen to these women. And I'm glad that the Lifetime series is doing that, and events like tomorrow night, 6 o'clock at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Well, great work by you, Jim, and we appreciate you sharing the story. If people want to show up at the Museum of Broadcast Communications to hear more, they can do that. Thank you, Jim.
You bet.
Jim DeRogatis, longtime music critic at the Sun-Times and longtime journalist who happened to expose this story many years ago. Certainly been following it ever since. Much more to come here on WGN Radio. Stay with us. Back here live in the Skyline Studios, this is Anna DeVlantis. Thank you for joining us, along with Lauren Lapcut in the studio. You'll find this interesting, Lauren. Mark Lazarus, you know, formerly Chicago Hawks and all writer, now with The Athletic. You know, Bears season is over and baseball season hasn't begun when there are exactly 22 members of the press, including 7 cameras at an optional Blackhawks practice today.
Oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Getting a lot of attention. Do they deserve it? What's going on?
I think they do. Obviously, one big story of the season has been inconsistency, but it seems lately, at least the past month or so, they're starting to get more consistent, which is strange because they still have a lot of injuries. Mm-hmm. So what does that say about some of the players that are missing, or how the players that are playing are really stepping up? It's been interesting.
Right now, caller number 19, you get to go to tomorrow's game, 312-981-7200, Blackhawks versus the Flames tomorrow night at the UC. That's courtesy of Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, and Plumbing for all the right reasons. Four Seasons. Find them online at fourseasonsheating.com and keep tuning in for more chances to win. Pair of Blackhawks tickets today throughout the show. Rokan Show today is going to have some more tickets for you. 312-981-7200. Caller number 19. Good luck. How are the young guys doing before we get to Money Mondays?
They're doing very well. And let me just say, for tomorrow's game, one more shift for Adam Burst tomorrow.
Oh,
so it's a really good one to go to.
Oh, how cool is that?
So that will be fun. But the young guys are doing great. Actually, most of the people that scored yesterday against our big win against the Red Wings were young guys. 24, 22, I think 19. So, yeah.
Really young.
They're doing very
like
well.
So young. That makes me feel so old.
We even had another first time NHL goal for Dylan Secura. Even though it was his 44th NHL game, he finally ended that drought yesterday. So that was good news.
Oh, cool stuff. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Lauren. We're going to talk money now. Money Mondays. Are you going on a debt diet? That could be one of your New Year's resolutions, or maybe you have other financial goals. Carol Roth is here. She's a recovering investment banker. We always love to talk to her. She's a New York Times bestselling author, and she is also the creator of The Future File. We're going to talk about that coming up. But first, can we please pray for the Apple CEO, Tim Cook, who had a 99% pay cut this year. Is he poor now, Carol?
Yes, no, he's very poor, and I'm sure that everybody is going to be crying.
Really worried about him.
It's interesting. People always look at CEO pay, and it's certainly been an area of outrage for a lot of folks. And Tim Cook has a salary of $3 million a year, which is not outrageous. But then he has cash bonuses, and those were down this year because they didn't sell as many iPhones as they had projected. So he took a little ding. It was only $7.7 million of a bonus instead of $12 million. But, you know, the way he gets most of his compensation is he gets stock options in the company. And as those vest, he participates. And while the overall compensation numbers may look very large, if you are a consumer of Apple, you want your interest to be aligned with Tim Cook's. You want him to put out great product. You want him to service the customer well. And so for a company that's valued at $1.3 trillion, it doesn't seem like he's paid too excessively to me.
You might be right about that. I think when it's really difficult for some of us to understand is when the company seems to do very poorly and there seems to be, you know, shareholders are not doing well, and yet the company gives a ginormous, either a parachute or a ginormous bonus to the executive in charge. That doesn't always seem fair, and I never quite understand that.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, and one that I push back a lot. A lot of that has to do with the board structure, because usually the board of directors is making that decision. But it also goes back to recruiting CEOs. There is an expectation that I am worth a certain amount of money and that I have a certain amount of expertise and skills that I'm bringing to the table. And if you as a company push back and say, well, we're not going to give you this parachute, somebody else may come to the table and say, well, we are willing to do that. And so they're still competing.
I see.
In a market. And so even though we may say that's not something that we like, there's still a market at work. The best way you can push back on that is to go to the board of directors and say, we don't want you to do this in the future.
They don't always seem to listen, Carol. I don't know. I mean, you show up at these meetings and it feels like I'm not always sure their ears are open to common investors.
That is true, but here's the thing. With social media, people have the ability to amplify their voices in a way. It's been democratized in a way that we've never had before. And so get a bunch of people together, start a hashtag, get that trending. People love to be outraged these days.
This is something real.
So if you have something to be outraged about, and this is actually something that makes sense, you should be able to get more momentum today than you ever could before.
Okay, I like that. Let's talk about momentum in another sense, the soaring stock market. 2019 really ended out strong. You folks in the finance world often talk about the Santa Claus rally. This seemed like the Santa Claus drunken rampage. I mean, it was crazy, wasn't it? S&P set new records, a huge end for the stock markets.
Yeah, there are a lot of things at play. Certainly from a fiscal policy perspective, you had the tax cuts that put more dollars into the consumers' pockets. It made them feel more optimistic. You have more jobs, and 70% of the economy is the consumer, so that's a good thing. On the monetary policy side, which I don't think is necessarily as good of a thing, you have the Fed keeping interest rates very, very low, which many people say, oh, well, I like low interest rates. But when you hold them down to an artificial level, it holds back savers. It creates potentially bubbles in certain assets. So there's a little bit of a mixed bag of reasons why that happened. Hopefully, as earnings play out over the next quarter or two, we will see some sustained growth and a justification for these high valuations, and that will continue to grow. But I would not have the expectation that the markets or any of the asset classes are going to do as well this year as they did last year. I mean, it was one of the biggest ones on record.
And the decade as well has been quite a bull run. It's unprecedented in a lot of ways. They say the decade went without suffering a single recession, a first since records began in the 1850s. At some point, there has to be some sort of turn, I suppose.
Yeah, business cycles go up and down, and there's always an ebb and flow to it. I think the fact that we had such a slow recovery allowed for that extension, and then in the late cycle, we did have some good fiscal policy that helped create confidence and incentives for businesses and for consumers. But that being said, markets don't go up forever. The economy doesn't increase forever. So at some point, it will have a contraction. But that being said, it doesn't mean we're going to have something like the Great Recession that we had, you know, the last time around. That was an anomaly. That was a huge structural mess. Most of the time when you have a plain vanilla recession, you have a slowing of growth, and certainly not to downplay the fact that it does hurt certain people and make it harder to get a job, but it isn't the utter catastrophe. And I think the people having in the rearview mirror that this Great Recession that we had back in 08 and 09.
They think
that's what's going to happen again. And the likelihood is that you may not even notice the next time we have a recession.
Be slightly different. We hope for that. That's for sure. A lot of people hurt during that particular time, losing their houses and life savings. So we don't want to duplicate that. We want to be smart about our money. And we're going to talk more about being smart with your money with Carol Roth coming up here. She is the creator of The Future File. Again, we'll talk more about that. But we do want to get to the phone. Chuck has been waiting online. You were caller number 19. You're going to the Blackhawks game tomorrow. You excited about that, Chuck?
Oh, yeah. Sweet. Yep.
Big Blackhawks fan?
Yes, I am.
All right. So you got predictions for the rest of the season here, or what's ahead?
I hope it's only up from here.
We hope so. That's for sure. Well, Chuck, congratulations. You were caller number 19, and courtesy of Four Seasons Heating and Cooling, you get to go to the game tomorrow night versus the Calgary Flames, all courtesy, again, of Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, and Plumbing. Have fun out there, Chuck, okay?
All right. Thanks a lot, Anna.
Thank you. More will come here on WGN Radio. We're back with Money Mondays and Carol Roth in a moment. Anna DeBlantis here in the Skyline Studios. It is Money Mondays. If you have any questions, 312-981-7200. Our guest, Carol Roth, she's a New York Times bestselling author, The Entrepreneur Equation, creator of The Future File, and we will get to that, tell you more about that, smart planning for your family. But first, I want to get to this, Carol. There's a headline in the Tribune yesterday, and I think a lot of people probably saw it. It's been covered in other ways in the weeks before we left for the holidays and things like that. But now, front page on Sunday, a decade into a Chicago construction boom, some major players known for focusing heavily on their hometown right here in Chicago, doing huge development projects, are now shopping for land to develop in places including Denver, LA, Miami, Nashville, Austin, Atlanta, and Dallas. And the reason cited is not only the taxes, the tax structure in real estate, but the uncertainty about the future. And I think that was the thing most cited. There's an uncertainty. And developers are putting $100 million into a big tower, even the tower here, Vista Vista, which we look at out of our studio windows right here along Wacker Drive, along the lakefront, near overlooking sort of Navy Pier and all that. Those developers, major developers, are saying, you know what? We love Chicago. We're based here, and yet we are looking at other places right now. That is not good for our city.
No, I mean, none of the sort of broader financial implications are good for our city. If you think about the fact that we've been in this economic boom that we were just talking about over the last decade on an overall basis, yet last year, Chicago's real estate market was actually down 0.5%. And the reason is the broader implications that the people who are in charge of making policies for the state and the city don't seem to understand that growing the pie is an infinite opportunity, and trying to redistribute or cut up the same pie is a finite exercise. And so instead of making it a low-tax, business-friendly environment, trying to attract more people, they're trying to extract every dollar out of every person here, which means you've got more people flowing out of the state. We were the number one state for mass exodus over the last decade, which is just staggering. And it goes back to these ridiculous policies. It is incredibly expensive for people to own homes. I talk to not just these big developers, but you know, middle-class individuals who've had to try to sell their homes because they can't afford the property taxes. And then they have a difficult time finding a buyer because nobody wants to step into that property tax. And then on this last tax cut go around, we lost our state and local tax deductions, which means that mortgage interest and things like that are capped as well. And so until we get a group of people who have a better grasp economically that you want to create policies that you attract more people and to grow the pie and stop trying to squeeze
fix the problems.
Yeah, squeeze every dollar out of the people who are here. This is just going to be a bigger and a bigger problem. You're going to have less development. You're going to have less economic opportunities. You're going to have more people leaving the states. And that does not create a prosperous place to live, which is so frustrating because
Chicago such an amazing city.
Is the best city in the entire country. And if we had the appropriate leadership at the state and the local level, we could do this. But unfortunately, nobody's willing to have those tough discussions and also to, you know, just have some basic economic lessons.
Well, we have a graduated income tax that is proposed, and I think that it is supposedly middle-class families, and there are a lot of details to be ironed out on this. Details are the devil is in the details. We'll learn more about what qualifies as that as more comes out. But what we know is that wealthier people would have to pay more of their income. You see this in California, and there's a sliding scale.
You would assume that they pay more of their income, but you know what they do?
They already do as a percentage.
And they leave the state. And I've had this discussion with many people who are in the business community, who are the people who are creating jobs, and they say it's just not financially worthwhile when I can move to a place like Florida or Nashville or Arizona or Nevada, have a lot of sunshine all year round, and have a better economic environment. I'm already paying far too much to the government, and they're not using it efficiently or effectively. It's not like we have low crime, great roads, great schools, and all these things that you could say, well, I'm really getting a lot for my money. So yeah, of course I'm going to give you more. They're not doing these things, and more money's not going to fix the problem. It's a structural problem. So that's my point growing the pie versus trying to cut up the pie. They're trying to say, well, we've got people who have more money. Let's extract more money from them. But that's the wrong way to do it, because those people are going to leave. The pie is going to shrink. You need people who are have the understanding that you need to create the incentives to grow the pie is actually make everybody pay less so that you attract more people to come here and grow the economy.
Well, I think if there were more of a sustainable budget in place, people even in the short term might be willing to pay more, but it becomes difficult to sell that when you don't have the solution at the end of the tunnel that you're just going to pay more, but then the problems aren't fixed. I think that's where you run into trouble. But the good news is that it's not, there's still time. You see 40-some cranes up in the downtown district alone. Alderman Riley talks to us about how he's got a ton of cranes and a lot of investment, and really, you know, the downtown area has been booming. Mayor Lightfoot has talked about spreading that into other areas.
But the thing is that they build these projects, and then, you know, by the time it's done, then you end up in a scenario where maybe the economy is not as strong. You still have to fill those. And, you know, I wish these developers well. I hope that goes well for them. But I think it ends up putting a lot of pressure on the market. And unfortunately, from a real estate standpoint, if you own real estate in Chicago, there's a cap on what you can do. You can't even invest in your own house because you know you're never going to get that money back from an investment standpoint.
Not always do. 773, ask your guest why she thinks people continually vote for the same people who put us into this mess. I don't know if that's an answerable question.
That, I mean, that is, it's like, you know, trying to figure out insanity. I don't know. I think that people are emotional and they think that they're doing the right thing and they want to help people. And instead of looking at the economics behind it, they go with words like fairness, which in most cases is anything but fair. And they go with the emotional argument over the informed argument, and you end up with the same people over and over again. And you know that old saying that if you try the same thing over and over again and expect different results, that's the definition of insanity.
Right. I'm interested in hearing more details about the graduated income tax, which we will be hearing a ton of now into the new year as we move toward November, when voters and ultimately the state will decide whether or not that's the path moving forward, or is there another path?
It's a bad path, and if you're thinking about voting, you're thinking about spreading the word, you talk about things that you can do, start getting out and spreading the word that if we do that, you're just going to drive all of the breadwinners out of the state at a faster pace.
Pat, the firefighter, I work for the city. You can't even imagine the extent of the fiscal irresponsibility that exists. A lot of waste, a lot of mismanagement. You do hear that all the time. I know Mayor Lightfoot has made it one of her initiatives. She's a reform candidate. She's been brought in to create reform. And I think that is one of the reforms voters who voted for her in all 50 wards did. She carried all 50 wards. That's one of the things people are getting sick of being asked to pay more when you have a wasteful environment, and how much of it is waste. That's up to her to figure out, I suppose.
And I wish her the best. I think she has such a hard job, and a job that clearly I'm not even sure why she wanted it. But you know, if she would like my help or anyone I know's help, we would all be willing to help. But it's a very difficult thing to do when people are used to having their perks and their wastes, to tell them, no, I'm sorry, you cannot have them anymore, and you need somebody who's strong and willing to do it. And I certainly support Mayor Lightfoot in trying to do that.
I do, too. I think that there's a lot of hope resting on her shoulders. I think she feels it, and I think that she is going to be a good steward for that moving forward. We'll see what happens. Fingers crossed. There's a lot of problems to solve there, for sure. I want to get to this before we run out of time. You are not only a recovering investment banker and have authored all these books, but you also are an entrepreneur, and you've created the Future File System, something that families should know about. It's very helpful for every family. Tell us what it is.
Yeah, so this came out of a lot of personal issues with people around me, my loved ones passing away. I had a mom who passed at the age of 51 from leukemia, and a stepmom who passed at 55 from lung cancer. And so my dad actually created the prototype for this. He said, if something were to happen to me, I'd want you to know exactly what to do. And here's all of my wishes and information. And lo and behold, in 2013, back when I used to have a show right on this radio station, he was in a freak accident and he passed away, and we had to go through in the hospital and make a bunch of decisions, pull the plug, wrap up his personal affairs, lay the body to rest, do all of these things. And had we not had access to everything from his medical history to who he didn't want to have at his funeral, to where to find the key to the safety deposit box, to his digital footprint and what to do with all the different accounts, my sister and I would have spent more than an additional $10,000. We would have spent hundreds of additional hours, and we we would not have remained allies during the process. We could have become adversaries. And so it was such a gift to us. As we told people about it, people said, oh, my parents are aging. I need to do this for them. Or my spouse doesn't know what's going on in the family. Or I have kids and we want to make sure they're protected. And so we created this kit for under $100, which you can get a physical kit or you can get a Windows-based software.
And it's quite extensive. You just landed this on my desk. And I'm like, I got to go through this. There's a lot of information here. It seems very helpful. There are forms you can fill out. There's data about where to go to and what to do, how to solve these problems, how all the things you got to think about. These are hard questions and hard discussions.
And things that you don't think about. So even if you have a will in place, does somebody know where to find that? Even if you've had some discussions about whether you want to be buried or cremated, how does that affect everyone else in the family? Do you need to buy plots for 12 other people at the same time? This is the best legacy that you can leave your loved ones. Forget about the money, forget about everything else, is to have this organization. So if you go over to futurefile.com, you can buy one directly, so you can buy the kit, you can get the software, and it's very easy. We've made it so easy to use, and it's great for dealing with long-term care and aging situations. It's great if you have an emergency to have all of your family information in one place that you can grab and go, and God forbid somebody passes away. It's so important to have.
What a gift it can be. Futurefile.com, the place to go. Carol Roth is our guest. Love seeing you. Thank you, Carol. Happy New Year to you.
Thanks. And also, if you're in the Twitterati, at Carol J.S. Roth.
And you're a good Twitterer.
Thank you.
Tweeter. Twitterer. Can't say that today. Thanks, Carol. Back here live in the Skyline studio, this is Anna DeVlantis, 219, talking about Money Mondays, and Carol Roth, our last guest, who's the creator of the Future File. It's under $100, futurefile.com. 209, Gary says, I have an After Gary binder in my desk shelf. Outlines all my financial info, my passwords, thoughts on what everyone in the family should do. So you've sort of got your future file there.
My mom has what she calls her death drawer.
Oh. And is that the same thing, Steve?
Where all the information is and everything, yeah.
Oh, have you seen the death drawer?
No, you know, we don't dwell on it, but...
Yeah, but it's important stuff. Those are difficult conversations to have, and yet an important one.
She's got the name of me or my brother on the bottom of many of her antiques.
She's already allocated it?
Yeah, so I go and switch the ones I want.
You switch them?
Sure, why not?
Oh, you're not supposed to do that, Steve. Gosh, does your mom catch you?
No, I don't really switch them.
Well, you should. Maybe if there's something you got your eye on.
Right.
But you know what? That takes out so much of it, right? Because you want to preserve the relationship. And Carol and I were just talking off air here about how it splits up so many families.
The thing that's so hard to understand. I don't get that. I mean, I don't get it because I haven't gone through it, but it's just a terrible thing.
Yeah, it is. But anyway, that's interesting that you have that. Interesting that Gary does. The future file is another option for you.
Death, it's all the same.
I know. it's so tough to talk about. Oh, my gosh. But thank you for letting me know about that. And thank you to Gary. Right now, we want to talk to Paul Bryan. He's our favorite car guy on the planet. He's the host of the show, His Turn, Her Turn, and the go-to guy on all things automotive. How are you, my friend?
Hi, Anna. How are you?
Now, were you at some fabulous place driving some fabulous vehicle over the holidays? Because you always are. You're always texting me, hey, in Cali, in a convertible. I'm like, okay,
No, I've had a couple of weeks home. It's been great. I've just been here with my wingmen, Jack and Darby, the attack-trained Bichons. we've had a really nice holiday together, you know, with family. And actually, you're just talking with Steve about the death drawer thing. I've got a death file on my desktop of my computer for my son-in-law. Yeah, it's in the file is labeled "Paul is dead." Open this file.
I love that. I just have to say hello. I haven't talked to Paul Bryan on the air in probably Paul a long time.
Yeah, I know. How are you there?
I'm well.
You still have that Russian hat?
I do. Yeah, absolutely.
You look pretty sporty in that. You always
winter's
did.
Coming.
I was going to ask you, winter is coming. I know, it hasn't felt like it's here yet, but it's coming. Do your Bichons, do you do their hair do you poof it up really big and stuff? What do you do?
I kind of let it grow out, and then twice a year they get like a Marine Corps boot camp cut.
Summertime, I hope. You're not a cruel person.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, not in the wintertime. They look like Aquaman right now.
Mm-hmm. A lot of things to talk about in the automotive world. And one of the things is you are in front and center of something that's going to happen 1 week from now. The North American Car and Truck Utility Vehicle of the Year is going to be announced. And you're one of 50 jurors announcing this award. And we should say this isn't like something where you influence and campaign. You guys are the jurors. It's completely separate from the advertising world, right?
Yeah, it's the only set of awards, the only awards that the industry really cares about, because so many of the other ones are tied in some way to other forces that would have, I don't want to rain on anyone else's parade, but the 50 jurors that are in this jury for North American Car and Truck of the Year, we are free of encumbrances from any manufacturer. So the vote is pure. We drive all of these cars all year long. We go on the launch programs and drive cars, which is where I send you fabulous pictures from.
I know.
And then we whittle it down to a group of semifinalists. And then that day, all of the jurors fly into Detroit, or where we happen to have it that year. And it's whittled down to the 9 finalists, 3 from each category. There's 3 in the car category, 3 in sport utilities, and 3 in trucks. So next Monday is when the voting will, you know, it's kind of like the Oscars or Golden Globes or whatever, because we don't really know who won either until that envelope gets opened up from Deloitte. We don't know who won.
Are you allowed to say who you vote for in advance, or you don't do that?
I don't do that.
Okay, you know, fair enough.
You know, but I can say that there are certain things about certain vehicles that I found incredibly appealing this year. In the car category, you've got Chevrolet has come out with a new Corvette, which is the first time that they've moved the engine from the front of the car to behind the driver, so it's a mid-engine car now. And it's a radical departure for the Corvette. You know, the old Corvette traditionalists are going, well, that's not a Corvette. You know, the motor's got to be up front. I kind of like this idea. I think that it really brings the Corvette into the level of technology and style that it rightfully belongs to. I think I'm telling you who I place the majority of my votes for.
You're whittling it down for sure.
Well, you know what? You get 10 votes per category. You can split them up however you want it. The other ones are the Hyundai Sonata and the Toyota Supra. So, for instance, I could have given 9 votes to the Corvette and 1 vote to Sonata, or 3, 3, and 4, or however. But I think Corvette is a pretty significant vehicle. The thing that had me conflicted this year in my voting is that you've got to put a value proposition with where you vote too. It's not just what's cool, but it's also, how does this relate to people who are actually out buying cars? Mm-hmm. And while the Corvette is out there now, and they brought it in at a terrific price at $60,000, which might sound like a lot, but for a Corvette, and that will perform on a Ferrari level for 60 G's is pretty amazing. So the Sonata comes in there, and the Sonata is just as solid a family sedan as possible. And it becomes even more important because you've got a lot of car companies that are totally abandoning the traditional four-door sedan because there's so much business
in the SUV.
In sport. And SUVs, yeah. Well,
on that subject, I want to ask you, because there is some promising and pretty cool news about the auto industry in the state of Illinois, with several things going on here. The state of the fast-evolving auto industry in Illinois comes to a tale of 3 cities. This article from the Tribune: Normal, Belvedere, and Chicago. In Dead State Normal, they're eagerly awaiting a once dormant plant with the startup of some electric trucks going on there.
Yeah.
The Fiat Chrysler plant in Belvedere is now going through the merger, and they're going to have massive billion-dollar renovations. Ford's Chicago assembly plant is at full speed heading into 2020. That's good news for the state.
It's great. great news for the state. And thankfully, we've got that infrastructure that's there, and it's still, I guess it's still, it would have to be more economically feasible to renovate a plant, and there are some who would argue the opposite side of that, that it's easier to start with a clean sheet of paper. But for instance, up in Belvedere, where Chrysler used to build the 200 and a couple of cars, you know, those cars are gone, and they're sitting on a lot of real estate, and they're sitting on a lot of employees, and they have a lot of well-trained people who work at that plant. So, you know, Fiat Chrysler comes along and they say, well, you know what we better do? We better, you know, renovate that into something that's going to happen. The Mitsubishi plant that was down in Normal was a joint venture plant that was predominantly run by Mitsubishi. Mm-hmm. And then the Ford plant here in Chicago, you know, that's always been a rocking plant. That's, yeah. That they do great stuff. But they used to build the Taurus there, and Taurus is gone. So you've got you got a lot of stuff going on in the state. Now, there are some companies that are also building a lot in the South. They can avoid some of the union problems that they've got. You've got a beautiful plant with Hyundai where they built the Sonata down in Montgomery, Alabama, about 40 miles away from that. They've got a plant with the Kia runs at West Point, Georgia. I know that at some point in my life, I have had surgery in an operating room that's dirtier than those two plants that Kia and Hyundai do.
I hope not.
They're just astonishing.
Are they really? That's fabulous to hear. So I want to ask you something because we're running out of time here, Paul. But I did want to ask you about this because 72% of the new vehicle sales represented by were SUVs and light trucks. That's a huge number. And then I want to ask you about, wasn't this supposed to be the decade, just looking at the decade of the electric vehicle? And has that, doesn't seem that that's really lived up to the expectations of what we thought. If you look at 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, where we thought we might be in terms of what consumers' demand is for these vehicles.
Well, yeah, I mean, 10 years ago, we had sub 2% demand for electric vehicles. So after 10 years of hoorah and buy this and boy, ain't it great and everything else, we're still sitting at under 2%. The problem is that mass adoption of electric cars is not going to happen until they do everything that gasoline cars can do, including the ability to go hundreds of miles before refueling and easily and at a low cost. Now, you've got a couple of cars out there that are tapping the market the right way, and Hyundai has their Kona out now, which is a full electric. And I know that you've got emotional stake to Tesla. I just so think they did that backwards.
What do you mean backwards?
He should have been building cars for the lower end of the market, not the higher end of the market. Because now, as he's operating up in the higher end of the market, he's getting competition from where? From Jaguar, from Audi. You know, this beautiful new Audi e-tron that's out there. The E-Pace Jaguar.
Yeah.
You've got that. You've got a bunch of cars up on the high end. Porsche
All the people who were shorting Tesla stock lost a lot of money in December. You saw those headlines. It's hard to bet for Elon Musk. It's hard to bet against him. It feels like he doesn't always deliver.
I understand that, but Anna, if you separate out Tesla's car business versus their rocket business and tunnels and whatever the hell else he's got,
the car
business would have died a long time ago. He's yet to turn a dollar profit on a car. You know, it's not going to happen. And I mean, he's losing $27,000 per unit.
Paul, we always have these discussions, and we get nowhere with them. But I do want to ask you, is January a good time to buy a car? Final thoughts on that. I always hear that it is, especially if you want to buy last year's model, kind of new or absolutely new. Is that still a good rule of thumb?
Sure it is. Yeah, it's good. The sales numbers are out right now. We sold a few fewer cars last year in 19 than we did in 18. It's the first time that we've sold fewer than 17 million vehicles in 5 years. So everybody's kind of motivated. And yet at the same time, you know, the variance is like 0.1% of vehicles year over year. But you've got dealers out there who are really trying to move vehicles. Now, you've also got a factor in there, too, is that the dealers were pushing very, very hard here, especially in Illinois, when we got shipped by Springfield. And it's a technical car term, by the way. Which took away a great deal of the tax credit that you used to get when you traded in your vehicle. So now you get to pay double tax. You buy tax on a vehicle when you buy it, and now with a $10,000 exemption, you also get to pay tax on that again. Thank you, Governor Pritzker. Thank you, Mr. Madigan.
Doesn't seem right.
So yeah, it's a good time to buy. The market is pretty universally motivated, but everybody's trying to get out of this winter cycle as well now, and so you'll see a lot of incentives coming up around the auto show and stuff like that. So,
all right,
you know, the Ford guys generally come up with local money that they'll put on the hood of their cars in addition to the national programs. And there are going to be some other ones as well.
All right.
So,
Paul, we're out of time, but I want to plug your show. Paul Bryan is the host of the show, His Turn, Her Turn, a review series on YouTube. All you got to do is subscribe, and you get the best automotive advice on the planet.
It's fun. And you get to meet my partner, Lauren Fix.
She's great, too.
Yeah, so you get a male and a female perspective, mm-hmm. and we're like fighting brothers and sisters.
I love it. Thank you, Paul. Thank
hey, you know what? We've got to come back maybe after Wednesday when Carlos Ghosn comes out of the closet here on his escape from Japan.
Oh, that crazy spy novel style. Isn't he a former head of Nissan?
What a great story this is.
I encourage everyone to read it, how he was smuggled out of Japan in like a double bass guitar case or something when he was breathing through a hole. I mean, oh my gosh. I wish we had more time. But Paul, thank you for your time and thanks for checking in with us. Always good to see
Anna.
You. Happy
Take
New Year.
Care. You too. Happy New Year.
More to come. Didn't know Paul's also a chef. Thank you to the 262. Culinary great, Paul Bryan. Thanks, guys. We're back with more on trending topics here on WGN. Back live in the Skyline Studios, we're talking trending topic. What's trending across the Chicago area? And Steve Bertrand stepping into the studio. This is something you've been covering in the news. I think it's fascinating. The controller's office, Susana Mendoza's office, is saying they will no longer help Chicago suburbs collect from red light violators who haven't paid up.
So the idea is that if you are delinquent in paying, so the red light camera districts are local communities, let's say Schaumburg.
Mm-hmm.
And so you live in Schaumburg, you run a red light, they give you a ticket, you don't pay it. Well, then the Schaumburg would go to the controller's office, and when you get your income tax refund, they would withhold the fine money. That's what had been happening traditionally. Now, Mendoza says that her moral authority to stop doing this.
She said, it's broken and morally corrupt, this red light camera business, and I'm not going to be supporting it until it's fixed. In 2019 alone, last year, $11 million was collected through her office. That's a big number. And she's saying that she'll no longer forward things from the towns and municipalities, the different places like you described. And she's not going to do it.
I don't like red light cameras, but I wonder how it is that she's instructed to do it. Is it by law? I mean, can she invoke her quote unquote moral authority to just stop doing something she's supposed to do?
I think it's very, very controversial from that perspective. Yeah. I think most drivers are like, yeah, this is great.
Right.
Why not be delinquent then? I guess that's the other piece of it. It also sort of.
Well, I think it would go back now to Schaumburg. We'll have to be the one to work a little harder, spend more money to collect the money.
That makes sense.
The fines.
That makes sense. So that's where she sits with that. I thought that was a fascinating topic. Another thing, did you see the Golden Globes last night?
I did.
You watched the whole thing?
Yeah, I love the Golden Globes.
You do? That surprises me about you, Steve. Whenever we talk about those types of programs, it feels like you're just not into it. But the award shows you like.
I like the Golden Globes, yeah. I think it's a good show. I like Ricky Gervais.
All right, well, speaking of Ricky Gervais, here's a little taste of that opening monologue. We have some audio for you and see what you think. Maybe you already have your thoughts.
Hello and welcome to the 77th Annual Golden Globe Awards, live from the Beverly Hilton Hotel here in Los Angeles. I'm Ricky Gervais, thank you. You'll be pleased to know this is the last time I'm hosting these awards, so I don't care anymore. I'm joking, I never did.
That was just a piece of it. He went on. It was uncomfortable for some of the audience members. You saw Tom Hanks kind of squirm.
The facial expressions of some of them. Oh, my God.
Oh, you could tell. It was sort of made them uncomfortable as he talked about the Hollywood bubble and no one cares about your thoughts. Just get your award and get out of here. And even after one of the actresses spoke, was it Renee Zellweger? He said something like, all right, are we done now? Are we moving on? It was like, woo! Kind of dismissive. Some people didn't like that piece of it, and others were like, this is great. They take themselves too seriously anyway.
I think he was spot on. I mean, there was one joke about Judi Dench that probably went too far. Well, they definitely went too far.
Oh, definitely went too far.
But otherwise, I really enjoyed it.
But he brought up Jeffrey Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, Prince Andrew, and how the Hollywood community kind of supports those types of people. And what at one point he said, why, you know, you work for Netflix, you work for all these different companies.
You work for ISIS if they had a streaming company.
Ouch. But it was
a lot of jokes that definitely make you kind of get the facial expressions that you saw. I don't know how angry some of the people were there. But what did you expect? Like, we all knew he was going to be like that.
Totally.
And Martin Scorsese was the butt of a lot of the jokes. Mm-hmm. And he was laughing right along with
it.
You know?
He didn't take it seriously at all. Which he had this sweet little smile on his face. I was like, oh my gosh, you're liking this. It made me like it too. Did you like it, Lauren? Were you a Ricky Gervais fan?
I laughed at a fair amount of the jokes. So, I mean, I'm not really one way or the other because I really can't take offense. It's not directed towards me. I do think it was a bit harsh and, you know, knowing that some people had their families there, maybe a little over the top. But again, you get what you pay for.
His show Afterlife is very good, by the way, that he was talking about.
Check it out.
If you haven't seen it, it's not like him. It's a little more serious.
Does he take aim at other people or it's more of a drama?
He plays this small town British newspaper editor whose wife just died. They were madly in love with each other. Mm. And she died and it's him sort of, as he said, he's planning to kill himself because he can't take it, and it's a very sweet.
Is it serious? Is it black comedy?
There's some humor to it. It's not over the top funny. There's more sweetness to it than humor.
I bet. Do you think it's really his final time?
I hope not.
You hope not. It's funny because he kept saying that, and you see the looks on the stars' faces. We're like, okay, good. It's almost like some were choosing not to engage.
Well, there have been times I think in the past where he's been a little too in love with his persona. You know, and it went over the top. But I thought last night was pretty funny.
I did, too. I enjoyed it. I watched the beginning half. And then Tom Hanks. Do we have any of the Tom? Oh, my gosh. Tom Hanks. I just love him so much.
Yeah, right.
And then when they did that retrospective of all the movies he's been part of, weren't you just like, oh, my gosh.
You're like,
that
I love
too.
That one. I and love that one.
And
when
that one
I love
made
that
me
one.
Cry. And that one made me laugh. And here he was so good. Oh, my God. He was so good in that, too. And it was amazing. But his speech, too, also very touching.
A man is blessed with a family sitting down front like that. A wife who is fantastic in every way, who has taught me what love is. 5 kids who are braver and stronger and wiser than their old man is.
Oh, it was sweet. Heartbreaking. And his wife Rita was there.
I like also that he brought up people who were early in his career, like Peter Scolari, who was in the Bosom Buddies, you know, he went on to much greater things.
Soap opera-y kind of thing.
Yeah, he remembered all that stuff.
Yeah, I like that too. We've got finally here, Hamilton takes a final bow.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get to see Hamilton? I know, Lauren, you just got to see
it. Yeah, I saw it last week. It was amazing. So phenomenal. I was blown away by the lead's voice. I can't recall his name right now.
Miguel Cervantes.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
Fantastic.
So talented.
Great show.
You saw it once,
absolutely.
Twice, 10 times?
I just saw it one time.
Just once, yeah. I saw it twice, and it took my then 6-year-old, and I thought, she's not going to get this. And now all her friends are singing those songs.
Oh,
they
really?
All, the little kids, they love the songs. They're making up their own songs. Get some interest in history, I suppose. Really cool, though, because Chicago.
Can I just say that play saved Hamilton on the $20 bill? You know, he was going to be removed from the $20 bill until this play took off.
Well, they say $100 million was brought into the Chicago Loop economy alone just based on the 3-year run of that show, and it topped $400 million in terms of highest grossing production in the city's history. ticket sales, $400 million.
Wow, that's amazing.
You think about that and just what it did for our economy and that kind of thing. And Miguel Cervantes, the lead, is just such a captivating person and just like talked about Chicago. Mayor Lightfoot took to the stage yesterday and talked about how they just how wonderful they've done in the lives of young people. They had those special days for kids that they offered discounted tickets, sure, and free tickets. And they really were just such a good cultural part of the city and an economic part of
more
the city.
More than 3 years, right?
Yeah, more than 3 years. So, unfortunately, you have to go somewhere else now if you want to see Hamilton. But it is moving, I think, to places like St. Louis and some other Midwestern cities. So, I suppose.
It's a good show, but it couldn't get me to go to St. Louis.
Stop it. Really? You're that bad on St. Louis?
Well,
we like Hamilton, though. We're back with more here on WGN. That's Trending Topics.